We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
All right. Today, just keeping track here, is Saturday, the 5th of March in the year 2022. What is there to be said on this lovely day? Here in North Texas. Actually, it's quite windy and sort of overcast, but not cold, so that's something. I'm sure that everyone listening to this expects me to have and express some kind of opinion on the current world situation. And I'm also reasonably confident that no one listening to this will be terribly surprised if I come at it from a direction you don't really expect. So first things first. I am, as I suggested, back in North America. I left Munich, where I previously was, on Thursday, the 24th of February, about noon. This was a decision that I had made back at the beginning of December, and it turned out to be a pretty good one, I think. I arrived at DFW Airport after the sleet had stopped for the day. Neither of my flights, Munich to Washington or Washington to DFW, was disrupted by winter weather, even though I'd been receiving advisories that both of them might be disrupted. So I just barely missed that, which, in my opinion, is a plus. And then well, you can guess what news I woke up to on Friday morning. I was, however, very much put at ease to learn that my cousin, who lives in Kiev, has lived there for some years, had left to spend the weekend in Lviv, or Lvov, whichever you prefer, in the western part of the country, near the Polish border, making her fairly safe for the moment, although there are rumors of further invasion columns coming down from Belarus. What else is there to be said? Well, I'm safe here. My cousin is relatively safe. Lots of other people, however, are not safe. And that's important to think about, because you're hearing a lot of people talking about national sovereignty and historical this and that. Now, I'm just going to come out and say it, and this probably won't be a surprise to anyone. I am, at best, a skeptic when it comes to the nation state. I am not a nationalist. I am not particularly an advocate of nationalism. I have serious questions as to whether the nation state, which more or less pretends that your identity is perfectly determined by what government controlled the territory where you were born. Well, I don't know. I just have serious doubts. So I'm going to ask a series of different questions, right? I'm going to raise some different points. I'm going to start by pointing out that in Munich, The real estate prices are, by German standards, quite high. Some people will tell you they're the highest in Germany. That's not quite true. Prices are higher in Starnberg, south of the city, but that's an area of scenic beauty on an alpine lake, which is connected to the heart of the city by the S-Bahn suburban trains. So it's not a surprise, really, that housing prices are especially high in Starnberg. Supposed to have more millionaires than any other postcode in Germany. Anyway. But real estate prices in Munich are high, and they're noticeably higher than most other places in Germany, though they're not as high as in, let's say, London, and certainly not San Francisco. Now, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal some weeks back, not a good habit particularly, it makes me feel bad every time I do, but it does provide me with information and perspective that I wouldn't necessarily get other places. And they were talking about some folks who had decided at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, can you remember back to that time, that they didn't want to be living in New York, that they wanted to go move to some scenic rural area, and they could telecommute in, you know? And after 18 months or so of that, they realized that living in the back of beyond was not for them, that they actively missed the urban environment. And so they decided to move back to New York. And they found that prices for housing were half again or even twice as high as when they left. Now, in a market economy, we've always been told, when there's less demand for something, the price tends to fall, not rise. So how does it come about that with a bunch of people having left New York, and in principle, a lot of vacancies looking for renters or buyers, how does it come about that the prices have risen sharply? Well, we can also look at, for example, San Francisco. You know, housing prices in San Francisco are notoriously high, and notoriously it's very hard to find a space available, except that there are a lot of vacant residential properties, either for rent or for sale, with price tags on them that are very, very, very high, unrealistically high, even for luxury housing, even in San Francisco, which is saying something. Now, how does this come about? What is going on here? Well, a part of it has to do with income inequality. After all, if you think about it for a minute, people who have more income than they need to spend immediately for their daily needs will bank it, and people who have a lot more income than they need to spend for their daily needs will tend to buy things. Typically, things that produce income, such as rental properties. And by constantly forcing money into the market in this way, income inequality does have the result of increasing the prices of anything that is rentable or what have you. So it forces up the stock market, it forces up the real estate markets, etc. So that's at least part of the question. But another part of it, as it turns out, another part of it is Russian money leaving the country. As it turns out, there's a lot of these, let's say, vacant luxury apartments in London, things like that, which are owned by Russian interests or middlemen. Now, this may not seem like a big deal, all right, but let me put this in context for you. Russia is a country with a GDP smaller than that of Canada, about 10% smaller. It's 7.5% roughly of the GDP of the United States, looking at 2018 figures, which are the last figures that seem to mean much of anything. So Russia is not an especially wealthy country. It has about four times the population of Canada and slightly less GDP. So that's significant. Now, if you look at the GDP figures, the economists have a second number, purchasing power parity, which relies on the fact that in poorer countries you can pay lower wages, so goods with a large proportion of domestic labor are perhaps cheaper on the internal market than they are on the world market, and so your exchange rate-based GDP calculation doesn't necessarily tell the whole story. By purchasing power parity, Russian GDP is about twice what it is on a simple exchange rate basis. But it has to be pointed out that typically speaking, if the difference between the PPP number and the straight exchange rate number is that large, typically there's something seriously and fundamentally wrong with your economy. So here we have it. There are lots of people, as it seems, or at least a meaningful number of people, moving large amounts of money out of Russia all the time. And they do this, to a great extent, by buying real estate. Now, it's an interesting fact that in the United States, for example, a comprehensive suite of legislation was passed after the 2001 September 11th terrorist attacks, which were intended to combat money laundering. And there's this extensive what's known as Know Your Customer regulation that applies to banks and other financial institutions and so on. The real estate people obtained an exemption from that, which is still in force. They are not required to disclose the beneficial ownership of a property. So you can set up a shell corporation to purchase real estate in the United States and have your identity, to a great extent, effectively concealed. Now, is the same true in other countries? Well, to more or less extent, it seems. The Home Ministry under successive conservative governments in Britain has, at least according to what I've read, been very much complicit in allowing the movement of large amounts of Russian money into, again, particularly the London real estate market. Now, what is the implication of all this? Again, this is money which is being moved out of Russia, a country which, as we've noted, does not have a lot of wealth in the financial sense to begin with, and a country where, when you move money out of it, you lose about half of the purchasing power. This is concerning. Just that by itself, the fact that this is wealth which is not available to be reinvested in Russia in order to improve the lives and living conditions of people in Russia, that in itself would be enough to cause significant social strains. But then we get to the other thing about Russia, which is that it tries to have the strongest military in the world, or close to it. Now, for many years, the U.S. was spending as much on military affairs as all other countries in the world put together. This is no longer quite true because China has increased its military spending. That's the main reason. But the point being that Russia, with 7.5% or so of U.S. GDP, tries to match the United States militarily, tank for tank, fighter plane, battalion for battalion. And, of course, all of that is diversion of wealth and economic productive capacity from things that actually do anything to improve the lives of the Russian people. You know, U.S. military spending is reasonably definable as self-harming behavior. Russian military spending, as a proportion of their economy, is much larger. The effects of Russia's enormous military commitments are incredibly burdensome. And again, this creates enormous social strain. because the Russian people, the average person in Russia, can see there's a class of people who are closely connected to Vladimir Putin and his government, of two things basically can be said. Firstly, they can do whatever they want with impunity. Secondly, they can get whatever they want. They're the ones who are moving the money out of the country constantly. They are just raking off wealth. And as a result of the fact they're raking off wealth, they can afford all kinds of things which the average Russian has difficulty affording. And to a great extent, this includes foreign incomes. It includes going abroad on vacations. It involves sending their children abroad for schooling. These are all things that are very much inaccessible to the average Russian. So there's an enormous amount of social strain in Russia, above and beyond what you usually get in, let's say, export-dominated economies, which already have serious problems. So that is a piece of context that you really need, I think, if you're going to understand what's happening right now in Ukraine. Because Vladimir Putin is going on national television talking about how Ukraine isn't really a country. Whatever that means, I mean, Ukrainian SSR and Belarusian SSR are both charter members of the United Nations separately from the USSR. So far as the history of the matter really makes much difference, I would think that is the most important part. They are original signatories to the Charter of the United Nations. Elaborate historical arguments don't necessarily buy you much in terms of figuring out what you should do in this current day and age. And to be blunt, people who make them usually, well, there's a strong temptation at least to come up with seriously bogus historiography in order to justify whatever it is that you want to do right now today. I mean, Russia seizes Crimea because, oh, well, Crimea was part of the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic until 1954. Then it was transferred to Ukraine. Yes, well, in the 15th century, the emperor of Trebizond gave the Tauric Chersonese, what we today call the Crimea, to the Republic of Genoa, which governed it for generations. So the Italians could just as easily claim the Crimea on basis of historical precedent. The plain fact is that this is a bogus line of argumentation. That's the best description of it. This whole concept of, well, this historical situation was such and such, therefore, that justifies what I'm doing today. I mean, most Americans who have any kind of informed opinion on world affairs, which is a small fraction, but they do exist. When you say, well, Ukraine isn't a real country because it was dominated by Russia for centuries, you know, they're going to say, well, the same is true of Poland, and nobody doubts that Poland is a real country. In America, we even have a national holiday, Tadeusz Kościuszko Day, commemorating a Polish patriot who was a hero of our War of Independence. So that kind of argumentation doesn't really hold water. Matter of fact, if you try to be serious about it from a historiographical point of view, you'd probably come to the exact opposite conclusion that Putin wants to brood about, which is to say, rather, that the word Russia first comes into the lexicon to refer essentially to Kiev and to the polity that existed around it, because Kiev was, from the earliest times, the leading cultural and political center of Rus, the sort of East Slavic lands bounded roughly by the White Sea to the north, the Black to the south, the Urals on the east, and the Vistula on the west, which is, you know, where the Varangian Rurik founded the first sort of organized polities that we have records of. If you want to know what a Varangian is, by the way, it's a kind of like a Viking, except in the other direction, that they went down to the Black Sea, trading along the river routes from Scandinavia. And the emperors of Constantinople at one time had a Varangian guard. But again, these historical arguments aren't meant to be taken seriously. They're not being made seriously. This is not the justification for what's happening, right? This is not the real reason for what's happening. The reason for what's happening is essentially that Vladimir Putin and his coterie are putting an enormous strain on the social fabric of Russia. And so they turn to one of the most typical elements in the autocrat's playbook, which is to cultivate a fortress mentality, to say those people out there are bad. Russia is being encircled by hostile Western powers who are subverting countries that really ought to be looking to Russia for guidance and leadership. Countries like Ukraine and Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, those are historically part of Russia, or they look to Russia for guidance and leadership, and they've been subverted by the evil outsiders. And therefore, of course, instead of complaining about me and my regime, instead of trying to undo this regime which is making you poor and unhappy, you need to all join together, right? Come together behind the autocrat. And again, this is one of the reasons many of us were very, very uneasy about the previous inhabitant of the executive mansion in Washington talking about bad hombres coming over the border. We need to build a wall. Here's a tip. When you build a wall around a country, it is to turn that country into a prison for the people inside it. It has nothing to do with keeping anyone out, bad hombres or no. So that's a point that should be remembered in all of this. And honestly, my response to all of this, has been very much, the people on this planet are crazy! Everybody knows that war is enormously and cataclysmically destructive. Everybody knows that there's nothing particularly to be gained that's anything like worth the value of what will be destroyed. We have the most recent IPCC report coming out telling us that we need to concentrate all efforts on climate change mitigation and adaptation strategies. Well, that certainly can't happen if we're going around blowing up cities, which then have to be rebuilt, right? It certainly doesn't happen if we raise the level of tension in the world. So Germany, for example, now talking about committing 2% of its GDP and currently 100 billion euros to military affairs. Well, that's 100 billion euros that's not going to be available, and in the longer term, 2% of GDP that's not going to be available for things like moving people and historical monuments and industries out of the low-lying areas of the North German coast, which may be underwater in as little as 10 years, because there's a lot of those places where the they're very, very low-lying and very, very flat. And unlike the Dutch, they don't have strong flood defenses, basically because the Baltic is historically quieter than the North Sea. So here we are. And as a matter of fact, it's worse than that. How is it worse? Well, I mentioned the Charter of the United Nations a little before. The Charter of the United Nations. What can we say about the Charter of the United Nations? Well, maybe the simplest thing is just to sit here and read just a little bit of it. I'm not going to read you very much of it. I already have done that in the past. But we, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetimes has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, and for these ends to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, and to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security, and to ensure by the acceptance of principles and the institution of methods that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest, and to employ international machinery for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims. And things like this. Article 1, yes, Article 2.4, all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. Article 1.1, the purposes of the United Nations are, number one, to maintain international peace and security, and to that end, to take effective collective measures for the prevention and removal of threats to the peace, and for the suppression of acts of aggression or other breaches of the peace, and to bring about by peaceful means, and in conformity with the principles of justice and international law, adjustment or settlement of international disputes or situations which might lead to a breach of the peace. Now the four, the big five, right? The Big Five, who are they? Originally, the United States, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, the French Republic, and the Republic of China. The Republic of China has now been substituted for by the People's Republic of China, which is an entirely different kettle of fish. And Russia has succeeded to the USSR. But let's point this out, okay? These are the Big Five. These are the permanent members of the Security Council. These are the five states which set themselves up as guarantors. Guarantors of these points. The purposes of the United Nations are to maintain international peace and security, and to that end, to take effective collective measures for the prevention and removal of threats to the peace. The permanent members of the Security Council have solemnly avowed that they will put aside national or particular interests because if we have another major war, it will wreck our civilization. And they don't behave that way. None of them. And the United States has been an offender in this respect to a very great extent. And the Soviet Union, and now Russia, also to a very great extent. You would think that none of the people who are leading the governments of these countries has ever read what they have bound themselves to, has ever taken a moment to understand what they have bound themselves to. Instead, we have people in a world of intercontinental ballistic missiles who believe it's necessary to have buffer states between you and people you don't like. Well, guess what? That's not going to help. So far as I know, the only head of state of one of the Big Five or any nation state who ever personally witnessed a nuclear test, an atmospheric nuclear test, was Charles de Gaulle. I think it ought to be legally mandatory. People ought to know what they're messing with. Anyway, send me your cards and letters, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, United States of America, zip code 76101. Up next is Toby.
7.